Well, this is a little bit different. I think if you've dialed into today's VentureForge webinar expecting four heads in a grid on Zoom, I'm sorry to disappoint. We've switched things up. We've got four guys, possibly in future, four guys and girls, ladies, gentlemen, the whole mix in a room talking around a table.
Officially podcasters.
Officially podcasters.
It's labor.
Real people.
Podcasters.
Real people. We've always had real conversation, but now we're going into to real people.
And so. Exist from the shoulders down.
Well, yeah. I was amazed that Chris Koo had a body.
There you go.
Who knew?
Exactly. Full body. He's got legs. He's got everything. He's like a real person.
A lot taller in person.
Than a head.
Yeah.
It's strange when you meet people for the first. I mean, I'm not trying to say I'm massively tall because I'm only 6'1", but like, you know, some people are
only 6'1".
Some that's people are. Yeah, just drop that in.
I say I'm 5'10", I'm like 5'9½. Just round it up.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't lift that much, it's only 250, you know.
It's fine. But no, it's what a different format. You know, we've talked about switching this up for a while. Great for you guys all to join us. We're going to talk about compliance today and go probably down quite a few different paths with it. But before we do, let's start off with some introductions. For you that haven't been before, I'm Andy. I'm CEO of VentureForge, and we're a leading Amazon agency in the UK, working as a commercial partner with brands that typically do between £2 and £10 million a year on Amazon. Pleased to be joined today by some great guys, people that I've met before, people that I think a lot of you will recognise from the industry. Let's start with some introductions. Chris?
Sure, great to be on. I'm Chris, co-founder of KooCommerce. We do EDI integration software for vendors, so we work with vendors of all sizes across all different countries, UK, USA, rest of the world. I'm really just focused on helping businesses get their orders in, confirmed, shipments made, labels printed, and invoices out. And we're really about, you know, that Monday morning, Wednesday morning process. But across our network, we help vendors do about $1 billion each year worth of goods go through our systems. It's really cool. We've got people that do everything from tiny little products all the way up to hot tubs and swimming pool covers that are like, you know, 15 feet wide.
FBA hot tubs?
You'd be surprised. Vendor direct fulfillment.
Wow.
Hot tub. But even there, in Amazon, in America, they stock hot tub. Anyway, we don't. I don't sell hot tubs. But yeah. Yeah, a lot of you only get eight on a truck. So lots of trucks. But yeah, anyway, we do integrations, and it's my passion to help people streamline their operations and just get more stuff going in faster.
Fantastic. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
James, over to you.
Yeah, I'm James. I'm head of e-commerce for a licensed gifting company called Paladone. So Amazon are our biggest e-com business, and that's where the majority of my focus is just making sure that we're selling Disney and Minecraft products and actually getting them out the door and making sure that products stay alive, especially during that peak Christmas period, because if we don't get it right on the 16th of December, then the whole world falls down.
So your job is getting them out the door via Chris's software and into my house?
Into the hands of the Vandy's kids.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's a conversation for another day. But yeah, as long as you keep on your Amazon spend, then my flywheel Fantastic. Keeps turning.
Fantastic. I'm glad I'm helping. Yeah. And Travis?
Yeah, I'm Trav, head of vendor services here. So I've been in the Amazon game about 7 odd years. It feels like it's gone a lot quicker than that. Started my career at Amazon, health and personal care, beauty, pharmaceuticals after that, and now in the agency game. So done the Holy Trinity, done the trifecta of Amazon.
Completed it.
Yeah, completed it. Six, got the t-shirts, got the drama, got the tears.
The scars. But,
The scars. You guys don't want to see them.
The nighttime rocking in the corner.
Oh, yeah, no.
Is that because of Amazon or because the kids woken up?
Yeah, exactly.
Both. Well, for you that have joined us before, obviously it is a very different format. We usually have Q&A at the end. We're going to do that a little bit differently. We usually do our poll. We're still going to do that, but it'll be a little bit different. From a Q&A point of view, please get your questions in the usual place. Somewhere down the bottom of the screen is that Q&A button. Get your questions in there, ask away, and we've got our team online in the background and we'll be answering in real time. If you're now watching this on one of our podcast channels and you're seeing it after the fact, I'm sorry you can't ask questions, but if you drop us a line at hello@ventureforge.co.uk, look myself, look Travis up, or any of our team up on LinkedIn, just pop your questions in there and we'll happily give you any answers or pointers that you don't cover off in today's conversation. And the poll, we're still going to do it, but it's more for your benefit as you're watching. So we're going to ask you a question today around compliance. What is your biggest challenge with compliance and enforcement from Amazon today? I'm going to read from the screen so I get the options right, because this is all very new and all very different. Is it understanding Amazon's enforcement policies? Is it avoiding violations and staying compliant? Is it resolving disputes and enforcement notices? Is it working effectively with your AVS? could be a challenging one? Or is it Insure, you're just here today to look for insights? So if that's all gone to plan and you're watching this in the live launch, you should have a little poll on the screen. Tick the box, the poll will disappear, and it'd be interesting to see what your challenges are. I think I want to start off by clearing this topic up a little bit. Compliance and enforcement on Amazon, we could be talking about anything. We could be talking about product compliance, category compliance, tax compliance. God forbid, please don't go down the tax compliance route.
Got numbers scare me like that.
Mention tax and compliance and it's terrifying. We could be talking operational compliance. So maybe let's just have a quick whiz round and each of those areas, what's of interest? What does a brand need to be compliant with to trade successfully on Amazon?
So personally for me, I'd say product compliance, obviously having the correct claims on site, having the right safety protocols on site. So to your point, James, if you sell toys, are they meant for under 3-year-olds? Are they meant for over 3-year-olds? Are they choking hazards? Are they made of toxic materials? Compliance in product space, false claims, ingredients that are banned in certain demographics and geographical regions. Mm. I think product compliance is quite close to my heart, because if you do get it wrong, that's a straight and on cord, and then Amazon can block you, can list you, delist you. And then also review compliance, using Vine, using real honest ways essentially of getting reviews and ratings and not black hat. Tactics. So yeah, product compliance in forms of product safety and reviews and ratings, I'd say from my side, it's quite close to me.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Chris? Your world's quite different.
Yeah, I'd obviously echo all of that. That's definitely a huge part for me. It's about all the operations, it's to do with the logistics, and it's to do with making sure that you're meeting Amazon's internal metrics. So things like shortage claims, things like chargebacks, vendor lead time, it could even be the prep requirements like the bagging, the bubble wrapping and things like that for liquids, for glass, for perishable items, for your batch control, expiry dates. Not necessarily the most glamorous topic because, you know, it's all to do with just 50p here or, you know, 10 cents there or, you know, a dollar charge here or there. But obviously when you're shipping millions of units, those charges really add up. And, you know, if you're talking about damage and breakage, you know, you ship mugs and then 5% of them get broken because they need to be wrapped or Amazon charged you 50p to bag every one of them. It becomes very expensive. So I'm thinking much more, you know, getting those orders in, getting them out in a way which Amazon receives them effectively. So that's my kind of bread and butter.
So do not steer product questions in your direction. Do not send questions about packaging compliance in your direction.
Hey, we had to compliment each other.
And don't put toxic materials in kids' toys.
That's the underlying message.
Much more to understand what angle were you coming from?
Pretty much that. Yeah. Make sure that Andy's kids are safe. Yeah. it's all of those things for me. Ultimately, if you're selling products that are compliant, you know, you've in my space, it's toys, so it's EN71. It's making sure that the product is safe and you're able to sell it UKC, CA, CE, all of these different things. But for me, the most, you know, obviously making sure that a customer's happy and is safe and everything else is important, but I am a sales guy. I need to make sure that the numbers are there. And if those things aren't done, my product's going to be switched off. And even if it's not switched off, if I'm not putting it in the right bubble wrap and sending it out in the right way, I'm not going to get paid for that product. Hmm. So ultimately, that bottom line is the most important thing for me in all of this is if you don't do those two things, then I'm not going to get paid. And yeah, I don't get paid.
quite simple.
Exactly.
So what I've heard, no offense, guys, in that introduction is that bucket load of problems.
I mean, basically.
Yeah, no, you sound like you listed five things. Chris, you had six or seven. It's like this, you're getting a product on Amazon, selling it successfully, maintaining a successful business from a compliance point of view. Sounds like a bit of a
I mean, the other thing I was going to add in is probably one for all of us would be like things like brand registry, making sure you own the barcodes, own the ASINs, own the listings. I mean, who owns the buy box is one question, but you know, we see it a lot with, you know, people that just start out on Amazon, they just get barcodes from somewhere random. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you need them to be like GS1 barcodes and you know, all done through the correct routes. But that's not a super sexy topic. But if you then suddenly 6 months into your listing gets taken away because, oh, actually you've just pulled the barcode out of thin air, it's a compliance issue, you know. And then they're gonna say it doesn't match it, we've just delisted it, and your 10 grand a month product is gone. You
know? Yeah. And Amazon are coming down really heavily on that at the moment. And, you know, just having came out of the aggregator space, we were buying brands and we were acquiring, at one point, we were acquiring two brands a week. and those brands would be there and not doing those basic things. And it's seen as an expense. You know, it's like, oh, I've just had to pay $1,000 for a load of barcodes. But that $1,000 means that the product's going to stay alive. It means that you're actually going to continue to be able to sell that. And it seems like such a simple thing, but, you know, these were actually Seller Central businesses as well, not even vendor businesses. So you could just click on the button that says generate FN SKU, and they would give you a barcode anyway. You didn't need to do that. But yeah, we've seen, we saw products being switched off all the time. And like I say, the important bit for me is that was no revenue. We then had to relabel, or we needed to start a new ASIN and lose all of that history.
That's true, yeah.
If I'm in tall, I've got to keep my head in front of this microphone. I'd be like sulking down in my chair right now. I've been that guy on the grey market barcode.
There you go.
I felt all of that pain firsthand.
Did you lose them?
No. So the background story is I bought into a skincare business that had been, so I didn't buy the grey market barcode. I bought into the business that bought the grey market barcode. And we had one SKU doing 20 grand a month at peak. It was a nice little hobby business. And woke up one morning to our best selling SKU in peak. Main image was swapped out for rubber elastic exercise bands. All the other images had changed. I think the title was mine. The bullets were rubber exercise bands. Description was mine. EBC was mine because that was locked in via Brand Reg. But somebody else in America had bought the same barcode on the grey market and had equally got some control over the listing off the back of that.
What a mess.
And that was a nightmare to come through. It wasn't even as clean as your office. Yeah. You kind of half on, half off. Yeah. What are people buying? Are they buying a rubber band and getting skincare? Or are they buying skincare and getting a rubber band? It was just an absolute disaster, and it cost us a fortune. It's such a basic that if you start off from the wrong footing, you're screwed. That was a painful lesson to learn.
And something that's actually been, this is getting super nerdy now, but like it's kind of surprising to me is that Amazon actually sometimes was quite misaligned with GS1 historically with the standards that they were asking people to implement. It's like kind of like they took what they were doing and then implemented it in their own way. What we've seen more recently is that they've actually been working much more collaboratively. We've kind of been facilitating that conversation, saying to GS1, you know, what's going on here, and talking to Amazon saying what's going on there. Because when we tried to implement what Amazon was requiring us in line with what GS1 asked us for, we just said, we can't make these two things line up. And neither side knew that. You know, they were kind of surprised. And so actually then we've seen recently, they've been bringing some of those standards into alignment. But I'm going to get way too nerdy and technical here, so I'm going to leave it back to you on the details.
Come back to the product stuff, because we went down a bit of detail. Trav, you talked about products. I guess products is maybe more of your world as well, James, but certain categories have certain requirements. I'm guessing toys has got one set of requirements, skincare will have another,
pets, batteries. Electrical, skincare, pets, electrical, baby. I mean, most categories will have some sort of compliance, health and personal care, supplements. You obviously can't have any banned ingredients in fat burners, for example. If your fat burner is laced with ephedrine, obviously it's a big big red flag. Or if your electrical, if your PlayStation's voltage isn't set for the local regions, obviously that's a fire hazard. There's a lot of bits and pieces across all categories, essentially. It just really needs to make sure you stick to local laws, local compliance, and you essentially know your product inside and out.
That's one of those things as well that can catch people out when they expand, let's say, into Europe or into a new marketplace. Obviously, the plug's got to change, and the language on the instruction manual might need to change, but then there's going to be different regional regulatory compliance that people have to hit. It's not just as simple as, I take my product, I put it in a 3PL in Europe, I've changed the instruction manual and the plug, and away we go. It might be that, oh, Italy needs such and such a regulation, or Spain needs such and such a thing. And having either local people that can advise you on that, or expansion people that can help you with that, they can just help you navigate some of those pitfalls, which will be category specific.
Yeah.
You know, what a toy company needs expanding into Europe will be different from a supplements company going into Europe.
Yeah, my first role within the aggregator space was to teach them how to sell internationally, because they'd never sold outside of the US. And to, other than toys, actually, the US is pretty lax on things. Okay, you can't sell alcohol in the same way on Amazon as you can in the UK or EU, but everything else, it's a bit more of the Wild West. And my first hire wasn't a salesperson. It wasn't a PPC person. My first hire there was actually a head of compliance to make sure that the products that we were shipping were going to be legal, because And I had to explain it to the CEO. I said, ultimately, if we ship something and sell something and a problem happens, he's the one that goes to prison. And so then it was very quickly, yes, okay, signed off. And, we got that role hired. But yeah, she was brilliant, but she was really focused on that. But we would look at products and we would say, okay, what's the risk? If you were just shipping, if you're shipping a table, okay, it's not too complicated, but is that something that needs CE? Because it could be seen as something that's structural, it needs to be built. And these are the kind of nuances that are needed. But without those basics and going and actually asking an expert, do we ship that? Do we not ship that? And that could be a very, very costly mistake.
I think Amazon make this confusing for brands, if I'm honest. I always remember an example. I was sat in a room with a couple of our clients, I think it was at an awards event, and we just helped these two clients expand internationally. Long process, took time, costly experience for them because of all of these challenges. And a competitor agency was standing up and presenting at that event, and they presented from the Amazon viewpoint, which is, well, in the Amazon ecosystem, you press two buttons, that turns on pan-European FBA,
and you're live,
and your products are off and live. Yeah. I was stood there thinking, I wish the world would swallow me now, because these clients just paid me a lot of money for a very strategic project, and these guys have just said, you get into France by clicking two buttons, because there's a world apart. But you're right, the barriers of getting into a market, and we've touched on products, but then you start to think about, so let's pick a product that doesn't need compliance, a mug. Well, now you've got packaging requirements.
It does still need compliance.
And that's why we work with a partner on compliance.
Exactly. Yeah, because, you know, there's the paints in it, there's everything else. It needs to be food safe. And so even something like that, where you see it and it's such a simple product, actually, you can get yourself into a world of trouble straight away.
Even at a product level, that's got compliance.
That's it.
Then you get into waste regulation around the packaging.
Disposal.
Then you get into tax VAT requirements in different territories and how that applies. You can't click a few buttons and go international.
I think they were just selling them a dream that, in all honesty, they were trying to seem a lot cooler than they were. Either that, or they were just completely negligent and they didn't really have the final customer in mind. Yes, it's all fair and well and great helping your clients and your partners. That's awesome. But you need to think about the end customer in mind. If someone gets hurt, ultimately, like you mentioned, it's on you. It's on the retailer. Yeah.
We had a matcha tea brand, and really, really nice brand, really nice products. And the brand manager shipped £20,000 worth of stock into the UK and just went, brilliant, let's start selling it. Now, we had organic labeling, which luckily was actually accepted everywhere globally, but the packaging wasn't compliant. And so because the packaging wasn't compliant and because these were foil bags, they couldn't be relabeled because the relabeling looked really poor. So we had to just dispose of £20,000 worth of stock. And all that was just a simple thing on the label. And again, the things that you would say in the US, which are, this gives you more energy. Well, do you have the backup to that?
The claims.
And
false
do you have
claims.
Yeah, exactly. Now, can you say that in the US? You can get away with a little bit more. Can you say that in the UK or EU? Not at all. And even things like saying sulfide free, things like that, you can't have that front of pack in the UK. It needs to be back of pack. And that stopped another brand from being able to launch. Really simple little things.
When you say it stopped them being able to launch, I get from a compliance point of view, somebody somewhere can look at that. And maybe that might have been internal at your business and gone, no, that can't happen. But bring it back to the Amazon world. Are Amazon proactively now looking at all of these touch points? I get if you send a liquid in, they're going to want to make sure it's packaged correctly. Yeah. They're going to want material safety data sheets. But are they going to that level of understanding and checking, is that product labeled 100% correctly for our category?
I would say yes and no. We've seen it where some clients will list products and safety data sheets aren't even asked, and then it goes 3 months down the line, listings are suspended. Why? You didn't submit a safety data sheet. And it's like, okay, well, who's gone and done the audit? Was it a person? Was it software? Was it just a random picking? So I think it's a yes and a no answer. It's a bit of a fluffy answer, but it also just really depends which sector. And if you're selling products that could have corrosive materials in, for example, safety data sheet, yes, 100% all day, every day. But if it's saying that's maybe a little bit lackadaisy, Amazon probably won't proactively ask for it. That's up to you to essentially proactively share it, just avoid any complications down the line.
I guess the danger is you don't, they don't, and you don't. But when they get to it down the track, listings pulled, business jeopardized.
For all you know, you could be peak period sailing high, like 2 days, well, 2 days, hopefully not, a week before Christmas time, boom, listing suspended, and that's it. That just messes your entire Q4 and messes your entire operations up.
Yeah, I feel like over the last 12 months, it's really stepped up. you know, even from a product setup, you know, 5 years ago, you weren't having to submit safety data sheets and declarations of conformity and all of these things. Now you are, you're actively having to do that. But I've seen products that were live for 2-3 years. And in the last three months, we've been getting pinged to say, send us all of this data. Mm. Now, when it was manufactured, let's say pens as an example. Now, when they were manufactured, we got the certs done. Everything was completely fine. This was at a previous business. I just caveat that there. When we had that done, all of the safety data sheets, all the REACH, the Roche, all of these different tests and everything else, they were all done. Now, that was 2 years ago. That product's then been sat on a shelf for 12 months, 2 years. And then those certs, Amazon say, no, they're out of date. Hmm. And so we either then need to retest or we need to dispose of that stock because we can't submit them a test that was dated within the last 12 months. Wow. And this is where it's not just a one-off. You need to continually be on that case.
A big place we're seeing it in another sector-specific way is the grocery sector. Mm-hmm. You know, in the US, they've got FSMA 204 that's really ramping up.
Mm-hmm. What's that, Chris? It sounds really exciting.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's food something 204. but yeah, it's a federal thing to do with food traceability. So basically, you have to be able to demonstrate from, you know, I caught the tuna here, and then I froze it at this time, and then I shipped it in this lorry at this temperature, stored it for this many months at this temperature at this batch, and then sold it, and then here's that. And the idea is to go from the source to the consumer as a whole supply chain, and you need to be able to audit and document every bit, and particularly in the grocery sector. Not every type of food, but only certain verticals of food. And you know, obviously there's some food on Amazon, and the same with like supplements, for example, like batch control and everything that goes into it. You know, that's one of those things which is the temperature's turning up for those particular sectors. So that's going to be another sector I see huge compliance demands being put on. That's all they're talking about in that space.
What do you think is driving this? Is it the consumer is expecting, in that food example, more traceability? Or is it that Amazon feels they need to be more compliant from a protection point of view? What's the agenda?
I think it's both. Who wants to have a lawsuit? You know what I mean? Who wants to get sued by a customer if someone gets sick and they can't trace the origin of the food? Or to your example, the food has heavy leads in or metals in, where it's obviously maybe not good for kids or good for pregnant women or small weird nuances like that. They want to have the traceability and be able to turn back and say, hey, look, we did our part on compliance. You didn't do it by ethically sourcing it or sourcing it from trusted farms or trusted suppliers, or your suppliers, when they were mixing batches of protein powder, they contaminated the batch, for example. I think Amazon's doing it for, yes, to protect themselves ultimately, but also that's a knock-on effect to protect the consumer. So it's an all-in-catch win.
I think all of these compliance, especially in the product world, what you're doing is just passing liability along the chain. You know, and that's from Amazon's standpoint. I saw this kind of step up a couple of years ago when there were those changes in the rules over in the US, and Amazon were liable for the first amount of a claim, and then all of a sudden my products were being asked for more information. And what that's doing is really passing that liability over to us. And then all of the certs and everything else, that's passing liability up the chain further and saying, okay, it means that we're insured. It means that we're okay legally and everything else. But yeah, I think that it's going to continue down that route. And the more claims that Amazon sees, the more that that's going to happen. And the more that people realize that they're buying from Amazon, the more that that's going to happen as well. I think that, yeah, Amazon's been this kind of weird thing over to one side for so many years now. I think that all of the regulators and everything are starting to realize that actually they are not going anywhere. They're here to stay, and that they need to be seen in the same way as a Sainsbury's or a Tesco or an Argos.
There's a certain level of rigor.
Exactly.
On their business.
Yeah.
A couple more questions coming in a second on product, but before we do, please keep questions coming in the chat box. I'll say we've got people online answering those live. So any questions you have around compliance, keep them easy. I think might be the ask here, but please keep the questions coming in, and we will get to as many of them as we can whilst we're talking. So what happens when it goes wrong? You've got Amazon putting more pressure on here. It seems like nobody's sat here and said it's across a particular category. It's not in a particular area. It seems to be across the board. What happens when you don't comply?
So first thing they'll probably do is pull an Andon cord. So Andon cord is basically, the way I like to imagine is they're pulling a rip cord like on a parachute. It just stops everything. Your listing goes down, your buy box goes down.
It can't really be found anymore by the customer, and it's generally to a safety issue. When I was at Amazon, I won't name the brand, but they do a lot of baby care products, and one of their baby wipes batches had contamination in it. They pulled an Andon cord, and those baby wipes were doing millions a year from it. Big pharmaceutical company, Amazon just pulled and said, look, we're not taking that risk. We're not taking that liability until you can show us or recall the entire batch.
Wow.
So they'll pull an Andon cord. Once they pull an Andon cord, they'll immediately reach out to you and say, look, we need safety data sheets. You're either going to do a product recall, or we essentially going to nuke your listings and we can't be held liable for it. So I think first port of call will always be an Andon cord. And then from there, if you can't rectify it, have a nice day. Amazon essentially nukes your listing and destroys all your products.
Is that purely listing specific, Trav? So you're likely to see that listing get yanked until you sort it? Don't see anything across at an account level?
No, so generally not at an account level. I don't think Amazon will burden you as the entire operations team or the entire brand for one product listing, especially if it's not a product that's similar to other products, for example. So the baby wipes, that was an isolated incident. They also do formula, they do baby's toys, they do teething toys. The rest of that, completely fine. So they wouldn't do it at a brand level, but they do yank an Andon cord at an ASIN level and a product level.
Yeah. And you get various levels of it. You know, if there's just something on the page that you've said that's incorrect, you can just be search suppressed. But then the next step is a full Andon cord, your listing's gone. And like you say, right the way down to having a recall. And this happens on Seller Central as well as Vendor Central. And, you know, I have the worst of cases. As an example, we had a pregnancy pillow business that was doing decent business. You know, it was about 4 or 5 million a year, ticking along nicely, just a couple of products in the range. And there was a directive in France that said that these products needed to be shown without a baby in the picture, because people might think you can just leave a baby with a pillow, which you can't. And so we thought, which
we've never done, of course, ever.
No, you wouldn't at all. No. You'd never just leave them on a mattress to just sleep. And never. So France issued that directive. And so the first thing that we saw was our listings disappeared. And the reason in Seller Central, it's a little bit different to an Andon cord on Vendor Central, because you saw there are compliance issues. You could see that in the portal. And so we went back and said, well, okay, we've changed all of our imagery. They said, no, not good enough. There are also other things that need to be done. So we went back to the factory. We did loads of work. We got all of our certs. Everything was there. We had the full kind of SGS certificates and full letters from them to say these products are completely legal to sell in France. And Amazon just said, it's not good enough. We're not willing to take that risk. Wow. They said, you need to recall all of your products. Make sure that they are all safe and that the warning labels are all correct in all of the packages. And then we will reinstate. So we clicked on the button to say, recall all of the stock. Now, I don't know whether any of you guys have tried to recall every single unit from Seller Central, but it's impossible.
Must be all over the place.
It's impossible, because people will walk over to the shelf and say, okay, I should have six. There are only five. One of them must be on a truck. So it's in transit. So you'd have things that sat in transit for 3 months. That means 3 months with no sales, because Amazon
can't recall everything.
And there's little bits here and there all over the network.
Now that brand is dead. It's never came back. It's not happened, because
the flywheel got killed.
Those ASINs can't be reinstated, because there will still be one unit in the network, which means that it can't be reinstated.
Wow.
And all because of us not being on top of the directives and the warning label just being slightly out of date, and we had to do that.
This goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You might not get bitten immediately by not being compliant, but by not having all your ducks in a row, you will get bitten at some point.
It's the Food Safety Modernization Act, by the way, I checked.
James, something you've just made me think about is listing compliance. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about the product being compliant, but claims that you can and can't make on a listing, that's one thing I regularly see, whether it is guarantee, warranty, performance claims that you can make on listing. Safe, absolutely. Yeah. Phrases, terminology that you cannot use. Simple things like your first image on the listing has to be product on a transparent background. Mm-hmm. They're not quite in my understanding, quite as significant as a product compliance issue. You don't get the listing pulled. You might not get your change through. You might get a listing pulled. But what kind of little nuances do we find there that brands often get caught out by?
I think people are used to being able to fly a bit closer to the sun.
Yeah.
You know, being able to do certain things. You know, we sell a lot of lighting. You look on a lighting detail page and everyone has it on a room background, not on a transparent background. Now, you can still do that, but you're having to ping Amazon constantly to keep that listing there. Now, is it worthwhile because of the conversion rate? Yes. And we know that it's not going to be search suppressed or switched off because it's not a safety data problem, that kind of thing. But those rules, obviously Amazon's AI is getting smarter and smarter all the time, and it's looking out for those phrases and those things that can really trip people up. And if it results in people buying more of a product because of a false claim, you're even more likely to get switched off. And it's not worth the risk anymore. You know, 5 years ago, 100%, but not anymore.
I've been wondering that about the AI images and everything that's going to be coming out with AI. Like, you know, is it very easy now to just take a picture of your thing, make me a nice optimized image for my thing, bang it up? I could totally see that happening in many, many businesses around the country, all over the world, to be honest. And then, you know, the type of image that might get generated, maybe the little power connector is not like correct or accurate, or maybe it decides to add the Amazon logo in or something like that into the image. Obviously, you know,
lots of six finger children in the background.
Everyone looking very happy with three heads.
No, you're right, but I mean, ultimately, we have been using rendered images for some time anyway, and it's actually in GS1. You know, they've adopted all of the rules on Hero images, so we've already been using an optimized version of an image. And as AI gets better, people will use it more and more. But we're in that kind of uncanny valley at the moment where people can tell that it's AI and don't really like it. So using it as a way to place a real picture of an item in a room or things like that, it does make sense. But where, like you say, you get into it actually being a false representation of a product, that's where it's going to get worse. And I've seen evidence. I've not done it myself, but I've seen and heard of evidence that Amazon's AI is now scraping the text within images,
and like OCR, it can then read
It can read the text within the image. And so those things where people wouldn't put it in the text of
the bullets, but they put it on the image,
that might start to trip people up now as well.
I can say with 100% certainty from some testing this week that they are scraping A+ content, content to pull wording out. And I say with 100% certainty, I can say certainly they're picking up on it. The speed at which they're now picking up on it makes me think it's not human.
Yeah.
It can't be human at the pace at which they're picking certain things up.
Yeah, you upload it and literally 30 seconds later it gets rejected, and it's like this claim in you, and you're like, either they've got an army of people sitting in the back just watching every image, or like you say, it's AI.
It's tech. Absolutely tech.
Definitely tech.
I'm going to contradict you a little bit there. I think it is worth sailing close to the sun a few times. And I think one of my favorite categories for this is printers and shredders. You know, you cannot put claims. You have to show the product. You cannot show a claim on the product. But if your printer just happens to be printing a page that says cheap ink or 500 page paper holder, or your shredder's saying shred 7 pages, that's a really creative bending of the rules staying in the rules. I think pushing beyond that point, I think being smart within the rules is really worth doing. I think the chance of being caught out on it is rapidly increasing because of how Amazon are challenging these things now with AI tech. But I do think because of the low risk off the back of the risk is swap your image. The upside is my product now stands out versus the competitors because mine is a 7-page shredder. Theirs is a, I don't know, page shredder. I can't see many more examples there where I would sail too close to the wind. I think there's small opportunities, but they're getting narrower.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly what I was saying earlier with the those hero images on lighting. You know, that what is the risk? You're going to need to change your hero image a few times. But if you look at what a lot of the Chinese sellers are doing, that's where they're really doing what they're constantly pinging images of like all of these different features and functions and everything like that into hero images. And we can't keep up with that because we've got somebody just trying to manually click that. We can't keep up there. But if that's getting them a click rather than us, it's worthwhile to them.
It's a game worth playing.
Exactly. But they will also play the game of putting certain bits of text in the listing that I wouldn't do. So it's that sliding scale of risk and where you're willing to sit on it, isn't it?
I think it's also probably reflective of the type of brand that you work in, or the size of brand that you work in. when we used to talk to clients and we're very, very growth focused as an agency, we used to say something on the lines of growing an Amazon business is easy, but growing it in line with Amazon's terms and conditions and doing it profitably is a completely different challenge. And our job as an agency is to do it in a compliant, well thought through way that doesn't bring unnecessary risk to our clients' businesses. So, all right, putting the sales up by 50% in a month and then them getting shut down the next month. And when you look at some of those direct to factory sellers, the risks they're willing to take around not just listing quality, but review generation. Or artificial review. Yeah. I mean, that's a topic in its own right.
Or even the review bombing on the other side.
Absolutely.
I mean, like obviously, that's just like a nasty thing to be doing. But
we've seen brands get safety claims lodged against them just to take their listing down.
Yeah.
Actually, this whole compliance thing has got a very dirty side to it.
It's got a double edge to it. Yeah.
We had a brand, and it was one of those kind of push-up systems. And we actually had the patent for it. And so it was IP protected, it was patented, everything was all there. And there was one of those direct from factory businesses had came, listed their own, and we said, issued the takedowns. Well, we carried on issuing takedowns. And they sent us an email to our inbox, our info at, and said, if you don't remove the takedown notice, we will keep switching your product off until you give in.
Hmm. Well, and then the rest is saying like, we will win and it'll cost you.
And we said, okay, go for it. Let's see what happens because we think we've got all of these protections. So what they did was they set up a website, just Shopify, and it wasn't even they didn't even bother with our brand name. They just had a like load of alphanumeric in there and a .com. Copied our images from the Amazon website and then put in a DMCA claim because those are an instant takedown. And that instant takedown then has a standard process that needs to be gone through, which can take up to 28 days. That's the SLA.
Wow.
And so luckily we had contacts at Amazon that were doing it quicker, but that would still be...
They're just weaponizing
it. Because that was Amazon's process, instant takedown and move on. And we got up to VP level at Amazon to say, your systems need to watch out for this, but that doesn't fix it. And so we didn't come to an agreement in the end. We managed to get it so that our product was actually blocked from that type of complaint, luckily, because we had those escalations in place. But if we didn't, that guy could have just carried on pinging that brand and we'd gone through all of the right steps. We had our brand registry, we had the IP, we had the patent, we had all of these things. And because he had done that, and it wasn't even his image, it was our image, and he had just set up a website.
Played the game back at you.
Exactly.
Wow.
I mean, that's true of a lot of Amazon. You're like, it's an ethical thing, isn't it? I don't think anyone that we would ever deal with day to day would imagine to do such a thing. No. But you're in the world where some people do think that's an acceptable way to engage online.
Just against an advantage, I think.
It's just money, isn't it? It's just for them. They just see an opportunity.
They just see dollar signs and that's that. I can't remember who was telling us a story. I think you might have mentioned in previous experience about going on to compliance, but sort of roughly what you were on during deal periods when you do deals, putting on a cap of how many products someone can buy.
Yeah.
Yes. Someone went and bought like 1,000 units of this good and you're all high-fiving, you're all out of stock. And then next day they go and return it after the deal event. Yeah. So you've run out, you've lost all your sales velocity and they just go and return all your products. So you're right back square one.
So what, competitors skewered the whole deal?
Pretty much. Went and bought all their stock out and then just returned it the next day or the week after within the 30-day return cycle. So you're not competing anymore. I think you mentioned
it was a conversation we had the other week. It's a dirty, dirty trick, but that's sadly the world that you deal with. Maybe not so much these days. I think I hear less of these stories now, but there are certainly games still out there.
Still kind of weirdly terrifying though when you think about it. Really, really bad. And to build on that with reviews and ratings, previous life, when I was in the pharmaceutical side of things, we used to work with a supplement company out of Germany, really big supplement company, about £15 million or euros in the context. And 6 years before that, they had actually bought reviews and ratings from some dodgy site in Malaysia or something, got 500 reviews and ratings, excellent stuff. None of it legal. Amazon nuked their entire business for 15 million euros. Just boom, have a nice day. They're like, sorry, this entire business was built on false claims. Mm-hmm. So we can't verify any of this. So unfortunately, we have to shut it down. Luckily, they managed to resell it on consignment and someone else reopened it essentially, like as a third party seller. But essentially, they lost their entire vendor account over stupid mistakes they did 6 years before that.
Do people still do the thing where they take one listing, ramp it up, and then switch the product afterwards? Is that, I mean, obviously not in reality for us, but I mean, like, do you still see that happening a lot?
You do still see
it. And you know, you go back through the review history and you're like, hang on a second, these reviews are not talking about the same thing from 2 years ago. They're talking about a light and they're talking about a bench, you know, like, these aren't
the same thing. You can almost spot it in the BSR rank, that the BSR will shift from one category to the other at a point in time as the product gets pulled and moved. I don't know about a lamps. Now a skincare product, and you do see it, but it's the factory to consumer brands where we don't see it. And actually, this is probably a good point to bring the conversation back to, is when you're talking to established proper brands, I think most of them are going on that journey of how do we do this properly?
Yeah.
The only time I really see compliance issues cropping up around the kind of brands that we spend all our time around is actually via mistake.
Yeah.
Or lack of judgment or misunderstanding of what they need to do on the product side of things. Yeah. Listing, probably more common, because I think the rules often change around that. The product side of things, if you're dealing with proper, reputable brands, take a childcare product. If you're selling into Boots, Argos, high street retail, if you're getting that onto Amazon, compliance often isn't an issue.
Yeah.
Can I maybe bring us into a different direction? Because I'm conscious, Chris, we've kind of talked a lot about products, but your world is very much kind of operational compliance and...
Yeah.
Tell us more about your world. Where do you normally see the pain points around operational compliance?
Oh, golly, that's like everything all the time. You know, to do with, so Amazon's a numbers game at the end of the day. So lead time is a big classic one. PO confirmation rate, shipping windows, not hitting your shipping windows, and then prep and product packaging, and then labeling. I mean, that's a lot of different touch points, but...
We've got all day. Keep going. This is good.
Order comes in. Amazon gives you a 5-day shipping window, or whatever your shipping window is for your particular region. You violate that shipping window, they're just going to be charging you for that. Now, that's just a financial charge. That's one aspect of it. But then we also know if you're labeling your product incorrectly, when they receive it into their goods, they're going to be putting on a conveyor belt, goes through the tunnel. If they don't scan that properly, or if the label's wrong, barcode's crumpled, not accurate, not linked up through the EDI in the background, not done manually correctly on Seller Central, on the Vendor Central portal, then they're going to receive that goods and they're going to have to open up the box and scan the products one by one. So you sell 100 units and they only receive 95. Now, this isn't really compliance in the sense of, you know, your listing's going to get taken down, but it's more of the sell-in that, you know, you've shipped them 100 units and you got paid 95. And then that over the whole account level can be hundreds of thousands for over the course of the year, depending on your scale. So we see the same thing with vendor lead time as well, you know, PO confirmation rate, and those two metrics together on the back end in Amazon, they're the ones that they're looking at. They're trying to source a product. Person A is consistently late. Person B is consistently on time. Where are they going to buy it from? You know, where are they going to be sourcing it from? One of the really frustrating things on that front is the product availability metrics, is that you can say to Amazon, you know, this product's not available, and they'll keep ordering it, and they'll keep buying it, and you keep rejecting it, and they say, oh, your confirmation rate's bad. And you're like, well, I'm trying to tell you this product's not available. But what they actually do, so we've talked to them about this, is they have a very fuzzy system on their side that even if you say hard reject, this product's not available, which is pretty much the best you can do. You can also send in the EDI 846 with the, you know, the cost of entry fee to tell them not available. But even then they treat it as fuzzy because they don't want it to be that someone has a bad day, marks their entire inventory as permanently unavailable, and then it just kills the entire account, because that would be what would happen. But in a way, part of me would almost prefer if that did happen, because then you're dealing with a machine that actually works. Mm-hmm. But still, that's a big area that we see vendors losing out revenue by having poor internal, you know, metrics to be able to actually know my order comes in here and here's when it gets out the door.
I remember somebody else in the industry telling me a really good example of somebody who was shipping into Amazon and facing penalties for not shipping on time. And in the business, they just could not get their head around it. It's like, we get every delivery into Amazon early. Mm. We get it in ahead of the shipping window, and they're telling us that we're not on time. So you're not on time. You're early.
Early.
and they really couldn't get their head around that. I think there's some real nuances in the Amazon world, and dare I say, it's almost do what they ask you to do in the way that they ask you to do it, at the time they ask you to do it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we see as well is even things which are downstream of the vendor. So like you hand your parcel over to a carrier. I won't mention which one, but it starts with a D and ends with an L. And you put your label on it and they put their label smack over the top.
Over the top, yeah.
So you see it goes through the tunnel in Amazon, and Amazon will give you the cast and images. You can go log into the charge rate and you can see cast and image, six sides, swipe through them. Oh, great. Here's my package. And you can see your label and then bump. Over the top, blank label has covered up my barcode. And Amazon charges you and says, you didn't give us a label. And then you call up your friend, the carrier company, and say, hey, there's a consistent issue here. I can't just use you to send my products into Amazon. They do have workarounds for it. I should stress there are technical workarounds where you can give them the barcode and then they apply it for you, which we do if people want to use that carrier. But that's one of those very nuts and bolts things, which is a compliance defect, which will cost you $20,000-$30,000 a year in non-labeling charges. Wow. And diverts all of your boxes into manual receive, which is going to cost you the same again or maybe five times as much in shortage claims.
Yeah, the instant you're in that manual receive process, everything's falling apart.
Yeah.
You know, but you'd ship in box quantity. Your box quantity is, let's say it's six. You know it's six. And then the instant you see any with an odd number on, you know that that's gone through the manual receive. Yeah. And
it's not an integer of six.
No, exactly. Yeah. It's not multiple
36
of six.
Units and you've got 35. And you're like, well, you didn't get 30. Yeah, you didn't get 36. Yeah. So it's going to be 36.
Exactly. It's not physically possible for that to happen.
Yeah.
And then it's also with... It's that kind of smart receive process, which isn't very smart.
That really grinds my gears.
Ultimately, it's not smart. Unless you're fully labeling, they're just receiving against the first open PO that they can.
Yeah.
And so they'll say, let's say you have an order for 800 units and an order for 1,000 units. You fully ship that order for 800 units. They receive against that order for 1,000 and say, you've short shipped us 200. Hmm. You're then shipping that one for 1,000. They receive it against the 800, and then there's an overage and an underage, and it takes time for the two to tie up. Mm-hmm. And these are things that just slow down processes, and they slow down the payment being received. And it looks like you're sat being owed loads of money by Amazon when you know that you've sent the stock. They know they've received mm-hmm. the stock, and everybody then has a headache, especially the finance team who come over and just say, what's going on? Why are we owed £300,000 by Amazon?
It's actually one of the biggest issues I have with the Jeet and Receive program. Yeah. Because once you're broken off the pallet and you're just down to the labeled GTIN, UPC, EAN on the carton, it's kind of lost which purchase order, which ASN it was attached to. Amazon did mention the other day in a webinar that they do apply the internal tracker label on it. So they say, pallet came in, it was ASN number one, that's this order, goes on to this one. But like, I think it just basically becomes a first come, first serve. If you've got five purchase orders open for that product, it's going to be the oldest one, and then it's just going to fill up from the back.
Yeah.
And then, your invoicing might be out of line with that. They're going to say you've billed us too much on this one, and then they're probably not going to pay you back on the one where they've, received too much on the other one. Or it's just going to take time for that machine to figure it all out. So you get a shortage claim, and then you get a shortage claim reversal, and it's just causes a whole chain of mess. So that's where the license plate, having that thread all the way through. Mm-hmm. But even with all that, you still run into issues.
Yeah.
And that's true, of course, on any inbound to Amazon. FBA has the same issue. But
I was having a similar conversation earlier about the value of actually getting under the skin of how an Amazon DC works and understanding. I don't think it'd help you understand the PO issue and the PO misalignment, but actually going on some of the publicly available DC tours and seeing goods, where it's FBA or vendor, is kind of irrelevant, but seeing how does it land, how is it received, how is it then taken out of your pallet and outers into a tote, through the mechanism, stored away, back out, picked multiple times out to a consumer. Mm-hmm. When you understand that world a little bit, you can start to understand why Amazon starts to get grumpy and starts issuing penalties when you don't follow that process and how robotic and kind of systemized it needs to be to work for Amazon.
Yeah, and they definitely don't show you the manual receiving process and the guys with their abacus trying to work through. But the funny thing is, we talk about the rate of these claims and like how much they cost you and everything else. It costs way more if you get it wrong for Screwfix.
Really?
Yeah. And Screwfix, when you send in your product to a company like Screwfix, they ask for it as not height, width, depth. They say longest side, second longest side, third longest side. And if you went to one of their warehouses, you'd think Amazon are behind the times with it. And they will scan that product. And if any of those are 5% out, so even if you've just sent it as height first, width second, depth third, so the orientation's wrong, you'll be given a 5% charge.
5%?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because they'll say, we've had to then manually receive it. It's not just been able to go down all of the all the routing, so you're going to get hit with that. And obviously, you still go through a reclaim, and then there's conversations to be had there. But yeah, 5%. Wow. So it could be worse.
I think those penalties are the holy grail of how to tighten up your operation.
Yeah.
And I know we're not kind of going on a full operational conversation here, but the fact that Screwfix, or in our world, Amazon are penalizing you, says we're doing this because it's not working in our world. It's I think there's a bit of profit in that. Don't get me wrong. It's not just penalising you so you comply. There's definitely a P&L line for Amazon, which is penalties. But for me, it's that learning of, well, why am I being penalised for that? What am I getting wrong? And almost following that charge back all the way down the system to go, well, actually, I labelled something wrong. I've got my dimensions wrong. I shorted something. I sent it in on the wrong time frame. I think that, for me, is a holy grail of how to tighten up your operation.
A good point on that, actually, is particularly for people that are doing a mixture of prep and non-prep products, to really split them out as much as you can. So by prep specifically, I mean anything that looks like Amazon are going to have to handle it. So liquids, glass, anything that looks like fragile. If you can, you want to separate that on the pallet from anything which is non-prep. Because if they come in and see a pallet and it's just stacked full of glass or whatever else it is, the whole thing is going to get manually received. It's not even going to, they're not even going to bother putting it through the conveyor, because they'll just say, that will fall off, liquid will go everywhere. No, it's too much hassle. Put it on the manual. Put it on the, you know, each receive. But if it's only one jar of glass and you've got everything else, could have been smoothly received. It might sound strange, but it's either better to not send that one case or to split it as much as you can. Here's my pallet for prep. Here's my pallet that's non-prep for the LTL shipment, for which that would apply.
Yeah.
Just because otherwise you're unnecessarily putting stuff into their manual path. But that's a bit of a nuanced discussion, because that boils back to the warehouse on your dispatching side, and having that conversation with your warehouse manager, having that conversation with the team on the ground. You know, like you say, you've got customer specific requirements. You know, it's going out to Argos, I've got to do this. It's going out to this distributor, I need to do this. Going out to Amazon, I need to do that. That can be quite a lot of information to have, unless you've got dedicated teams for each group that you're shipping to.
I can certainly see the advantage of that, because the nuances of each of those customers. We've had customers say to us, well, what I'm doing is good enough for Argos. Why is it not good enough for Amazon? And it's like, it doesn't matter if it's good enough or not. Amazon has a standard that they expect you to comply with, because it works in their world. And we often find the warehouse teams in the more immature brands can't quite adapt to that. Well, what we're doing works for our other customers. Mm-hmm. Number of times I've heard, well, can't Amazon work our way? It's like,
good luck.
No, good luck with that conversation.
I always enjoy that, because, you know, Amazon's change in share price in a day is probably the delta. The delta in their share price daily is probably the same as their revenue is 10 to 100x over. And I've had exactly that conversation before with warehouse managers and with ops teams, and they say, well, we don't have to do all of this for Argos. And I said, but you need a 7-digit code on all of your Argos boxes, because that's the way that they work, because that's their catalog number. That's the way that it works through. So you're already happy to do a labeling process for those guys, because that's in your wheelhouse and you feel comfortable with that. But you're not happy to do a different labeling process for this customer, because they're asking for it.
Great point. Great point. Conscious at this point, might be more questions coming in for your direction, Chris. Just a reminder, if you have any questions that you want to ask, you know, please pop those into the chat and we'll get to them as quick as we can do whilst we're having the conversation. I suspect most of these will be going in Chris's direction as they come in, and we'll have people that can help with that. Moving on to kind of being a bit more proactive then, and maybe just kind of bring the conversation to a close. We've talked, there's product, there's listings, there's operational compliance. What tips would you give brands that are dealing with Amazon to be on the front foot with compliance, no matter which angle it's coming from?
I think, obviously, understand your category and your product, first of all. No one knows your product better than you do. And with that, do your homework and your research geographically, category-wise, price-wise, competitor-wise, because obviously we've spoken, you'll get competitors that'll do some naughty things to get your products delisted. So I think, be proactive with it. Know the local laws, know the local concentrations. If you're selling products with a mixture of ingredients, for example, skincare products, supplement products. So know your product inside and out, know the local laws, and just stick to the rules, essentially. I know it's quite a boring answer, but just play the game with Amazon. Don't try and fight against them, because you will lose every single time.
Coming from an ex-Amazonian.
I've had many a tough conversation with skincare brands and protein powder brands where it's just like, oh, Trav, can you just do this for us? I'm like, no, sorry, it's against the rules. If I do that, putting my job in jeopardy, putting Amazon in jeopardy, opening to lawsuits, and it's just not worth it. So play the Amazon game, stick to the compliance, know your local laws, and just get on with it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and if you know that you are right, it's making sure that you use the tools and the systems that Amazon give you correctly as well. You know, an and on cord, reply to the email. Don't raise a separate case for it. Make sure that you're following those. Follow your escalation routes. You know, don't just go to your AVS and say, my product's been switched off, switch it back on. because the first question will always be, have you raised a case?
Yeah.
And even as annoying as seller support is, you need to do those processes and you need to actually read what comes back as well, because sometimes it does actually answer, even if it doesn't seem like it does. Sometimes it gives you very, very clearly what needs to be done, and actually follow it, use your escalation, go through the processes, and it's painful. And similarly on the op side as well, actually follow the path and work it out, because chances are a lot of the time it's not Amazon that have done something wrong, it's the business that's done something wrong. You know, I had I had 100 grand in shortages. Actually, all of that stock was sat in our warehouse.
All right. Because, just been over invoiced or just...
No, not even that. The pallets had shifted while they were in the truck. So they just got bounced back into the warehouse. Obviously, we've said we've shipped it, but we didn't actually reconcile it on the other end to say we've received that stock back in, cancel that order off, because there was no process for it.
I see.
Luckily, I managed to shake hands with Amazon on a part claim, and because they couldn't find the stock, but they could see that it came in, but there was no record of it being rejected on their end. So it was a win in the end. but yeah, with that, it was our warehouse that was at fault. It was our process that wasn't strong enough. Yeah. And we had to build a process off the back of that. Hmm. But yeah.
I think my top tip would be just around education and having the discussion internally. So you mentioned going on the Amazon tours. You can go publicly available ones. In the UK and across Europe, they're running vendor days as well, which are really, if you've not been on one, they're kind of invite only, but they run about 4 or 5 across the year. Vendor managers will get together and invite 20, 30 brands at once. Sit down 2 days, go around, you know, they look through everything. They do the fulfillment center tour. They do the, here's the different supply chain programs. Here's the catalog. Here's the updates to this. It's a little bit, you know, some of it's more your cup of tea, some of it's not so much. But part of that is very deep dive on here's how it comes through. In addition to the public tours, I'd really recommend getting on them. And then that's the education on the Amazon side. And then it's also internally, like you're saying, you know, customer one needs something, Amazon needs something else. And unless the people all the way through the chain understand why we need to do something, the relevance of it, the financial impact, if we don't do something, then until you get those things, change isn't going to happen on the ground. Mm-hmm. And some people will say to you, well, I don't want to do that. And then you just say, well, if we don't do it, it's going to cost us X hundred thousand pounds over the next year. So we're doing it. You know, oh, it's going to take me ages. Okay, hire more people. You know, it's only at Christmas, get temporary people in, or rework the stock in advance. Dedicate a particular inventory location to just reworked stock, something like that. You know, we'd have to bag everything. How many units are we going to sell? Let's take 50% of our projection, rework it so that when it comes in on a Monday, we're not scrambling around.
You're on the front foot.
You know what I mean? You're there. Like, but those kind of things. And actually, that's an education piece internally. You might get it wrong. You might bag it all and then have to unbag it or unbag 30% because Argos needs it and Amazon's demand didn't happen like you expected it would. Okay, but it's trying to calculate that risk, and they do those kind of things internally.
Great tips, guys. Thank you very much. I think to all of you and to everyone who's joined today, thank you very much for joining us on our first ever VentureForge podcast. I personally enjoyed it. I think the format, the conversation, 4 people around a table having a cup around a chat has worked very, very well. So please watch this space. There's much more of this to come. All of these episodes will start to be released onto wherever you get your podcast from. So watch Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts. We could end up anywhere. But please join us next month when our next episode will go out. Thanks to you guys. Thanks to everyone at home. Enjoy the rest of your day.